Okay, today is a very auspicious occasion. We have a lot of things coming together here, a lot. You're going to have to hold together lots of different pieces of thread, and we're going to braid them all into one challah. Okay? We have today Parshas Tetzaveh, which at the conclusion of the discussion of what we started last week, which is the Aron, the menorah, the Shulchan, this week the more about the menorah, the Big Day Kahuna. Finally, we get to the Mizbeach HaKetores, the golden Mizbeach of incense. That's very important to discuss because it is very related to Purim. And the Ramban asks, everybody asks, why the Mizbeach HaKetores is not dealt with back in Terumah with the menorah and the Shulchan and the Aron, but here at the end, because we'll see that through the Ketores, everything comes together. The Ketores is the end-all and be-all. It's the high point of the Yom Kippur Purim, Yom Kippurim, service of the day when the Kohen Gadol went into the Kodesh HaKadoshim with the Ketores and made it smoke. That was the high point. That's when the thread turned from red to white and the Jewish people knew that they were purified, that they were atoned for. So the Ketores on Yom Kippurim is the high point. The Ketores relating to Purim is also the high point, and so we have to ask ourselves, where do we find the Ketores in Purim? You should know this already. Anyone have any ideas? Tanya's not allowed to answer. Yeah, and neither are you. Or anyone who is in any earlier show this week. Mordechai. His name is one of the names of the spices in the Ketores. What else? Was Esther her real name? Hadassah. Hadassim, the sweet-smelling myrtle in the lulav, in the sukkah, on sukkahs, okay, which comes after Yom HaKippurim, right? The goal on Purim is that, the Gemara says, Chayiv Adam Lebsume Bapuri, a person has to get drunk, but the word Besume means Besamim. A person has to be intoxicated with smell, and we drink, but that word besamim is used, as opposed to shikar or something like that, you know, to drink wine. Chayv adam libsume bapuria. So there's clearly a parallel here, plus kippurim, purim, ketores. These things have to be put together. That's one of our jobs, to figure that out. Second of all, in our investigation of the relationship of ketores to purim, beyond the Beis HaMikdash itself and Yom HaKippurim, we are going to look into the origin of Ketores, and we're going to see that it was the Malach HaMavis that gave Moshe Rabbeinu the Ketores. Now, the Malach HaMavis gave the Ketores to Moshe. Leave it at that for a moment. We're going to get back to it. We actually spoke about this point, I think, a year ago on this parsha. Hopefully you'll trigger your memory. The Malach HaMavis gave Moshe the secret of the Ketores. Okay, today is Moshe Rabbeinu's yard site. So Moshe Rabbeinu and birthday. We're talking about that too. The Moshe and the Ketores are very related, and Moshe and Haman are very, very related. By the way, most of this is all Rav Moshe Shapiro. Amazing stuff. Just amazing, you know. You read it and you just laugh because it's so delightful. To, you know, we'll talk about delight. So he says, he brings here the Gemara. There's a Gemara that says, that asks two questions, and only regarding these two people. Moshe min ha-Torah minayin. Where do you find a hint to Moshe in the Torah? Bishagam. So there's a pasuk right before the flood that Hashem says, when looking at humanity, in Bereshis, Perek Vav, pasuk 3, lo yadun ruchi ba'adam la'olam bishagam hu basar. Hashem says, my spirit will not deliberate indefinitely on account of man. Bishegam, in that also he is flesh. The gematria of Bishegam is the gematria of Moshe. Very strange, obscure reference about destroying the world, that Hashem's spirit will not indefinitely rest in them. Bishegam, gematria Moshe, in that they are flesh. Right after that, the Gemara asks another question. Haman min ha-Torah minayin. Hamin ha'eitz asher amarti bilti sochem and achaltem, from the tree that I told you not to eat from, did you eat? So the Gemara only asks about these two. They are juxtaposed with each other. Where is Moshe? Moshe is in that they are also flesh. Haman is in, did you eat from the tree? Haman and Moshe related to each other. Haman gets the ketores. Mordechai and Esther are the ketores. They represent the ketores on Purim. Who gave Moshe the ketores? We just said the Malach HaMavis. Who's the Malach HaMavis in the Purim story? Haman. Somehow the Malach HaMavis gives life to, gives away the secret of, right? Brings the world the pleasure of the ketores. Who elevated Esther? Who elevated Mordechai personally? Haman. Because of the incense offering. Thank you. I'm sorry. The incense offering in the Beis HaMikdash. There's a golden altar inside the sanctum, in the sanctuary. It was an incense altar that they burned a combination of ingredients, of spices, and it caused a cloud to form in the Mishkan. And it is a very, very precious service, the last of all the services. It showed that God's glory was resting there. And the high point, as we said, of the Yom Kippur service, when the incense was brought into the Holy of Holies, the inner sanctum by the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. So we're talking about how Ketores and Purim are related. So interestingly enough, as the Malach HaMavis gives Moshe, who's born today and dies today, Ketores transpose this. Haman's a Malach HaMavis. Esther and Mordechai are the spices. Mordechai is one of the names of the spices in the incense offering. Who actually promotes them? It's Haman, the Malach HaMavis, who gives us Mordechai and Esther and promotes them, brings them to life. Haman put Esther on the throne, not intentionally, but nothing that happened to him intentionally. He was trying to do one thing and the opposite happened to him. It was him who drove Mordechai around, who elevated Mordechai. It was him who amassed huge wealth that went to Mordechai. Mordechai and Esther got the whole estate. He was the one, Mordechai took his place. He was the one that prepared such an important position in the empire for Mordechai to take over. So the Malach HaMavis gave birth to the flowering of the Esther and Mordechai compared to Ketores. We'll take it even further. Haman, it says, was so happy when the lot fell out on in Adar, right? Why? Because Moshe died. All right. Kevan shenafal pur b'chodesh Adar, when the lottery fell in the month of Adar, samach simcha gedola. He had a tremendous simcha. That simcha, by the way, again, comes back to destroy him, and we take the simcha. Lehudim haisa ora v'simcha v'sason v'kar. It was our simcha, not his. Everything that he tried to do fell boomeranged on him and it became ours. So that simcha became ours. Oh, he had a simcha gedola. Amar nafali pur b'yerech shemes bo Moshe. He said, look at that. How fortuitous is this? The lottery fell out in the month that Moshe died. However, what do we know? Right. So we are told, and then the Gemara tells us, lo haya yodea, but he didn't know, Shebeshiva ba'adar, on the 7th of Adar, Mace, he died, true. Ubeshiva ba'adar nolad, but on the 7th he was born. Now, how did he not know that? If he knew when he died, he knew when he was born. So the Gemara is telling us something in its usual riddle form that's very fundamental, very, you know, that stands in the heights of the, you know, the secrets and the kohos, the powers that drive this world forward. And the Gemara adds like this. The Gemara says what is this relationship between the birth of Moshe and the death of Moshe? Let the birth come and atone for his death. He knew he died in Adar. He didn't know he was born in Adar. Let his birth come and atone for his death. What does that mean? The birth comes before the death. Atonement comes after something. It doesn't come before something. So what are they trying to tell us when they say, let his birth atone for his death? So we have to put this piece of the puzzle together, the Zion, Adar, Haman, his birth, his death, and together. And the next thing is that two things we have to talk about. We have to talk about wine and Purim and Pesach. Purim is the end of the year, Adar. Nisan is the beginning of the year. We always keep Purim, by the way, near Pesach. So if there's two Adars, which we sometimes have in a leap year, we keep Purim in the second Adar. Okay. Now, Pesach was the birth of the Jewish people. Purim seemingly was the death, the annihilation Adar of the Jewish people. However, it wasn't the annihilation of the Jewish people. It was the rebirth of the Jewish people. So birth, what looks like death, full circle, the death of what seems to be the death, comes full circle and is seen finally to be the rebirth, right? That really is what Vnahapocho is all about. And to add to this, we have to just keep in mind the mitzvah to, on both of these days, Pesach, we do the Arba Kosos, mitzvah Drabanan, Purim, we drink. And there's a secret in the wine. There was wine, by the way, in the cave of Lot and his daughters, you know. It's a part of the Mashiach process. Wine is very interesting. Just like Adar seemingly was our death and our annihilation, but it was our rebirth. Just like Haman, the Malach HaMavis, gave birth to Esther and Mordechai, brought them, promoted them, so to speak, brought them the Ketores. And the Ketores we know, when Moshe goes up to Shemaim and the Malachim give him gifts and the Malach HaMavis gives him the Ketores, we're told in that Gemara that the Ketores is life, and Aaron used it to stop a plague. Whose plague? The plague of Korah, who tried to undermine Moshe and Moshe's role. So there was a plague. People were dying after Korah was swallowed up, and it was the Ketores that stopped the death, right? So you have the whole idea that what the death gives birth to the life. You have that Nisan Adar, and you have it in wine. When you pick a grape off the vine, you could be standing next to the vine. You can have the grape in your hand. It looks like a grape. You don't. What bracha do you make? Ha'etz. You don't say Baruch Pirei Gafen. But years later, when it doesn't look like a grape or smell like a grape, and you think you keep something along, and it ferments and it rots and it changes its identity. It's not what it was. Then what bracha do you make? Ha'gafen. In other words, the long down the road when it's totally transformed. And it's, so to speak, spoiled or fermented. Guess what it is? Then it's wine. Then it's so much more precious than the grape. Then you make Baruch Pirei Gafen. This is the theme. The theme is that what looks like death gives life. Right? Hagafen is Baruch Pirei Gafen, create the fruit of the vine. A gefen is a vine. And that's the bracha we make on wine. Now, let's talk about all these things. Okay? To put them all together. So in order to start, we're not going to actually go through that whole Gemara about the angels giving Moshe the gifts and the Malach HaMavis giving Moshe the Ketores. We're just going to establish that the Ketores is what stops death. It's used in the plague against Korach, and its source is the Malach HaMavis. But in order to understand how these two things work together, we have to start with defining the Malach HaMavis and defining, understanding Ketores. So Malach HaMavis, what is the Malach HaMavis? The angel of death, the grim reaper, some force outside of us called the Malach, the angel of death. Where does it come from? Well, we know where it comes from. It comes from, where's the first place death is mentioned? The tree of the tree. If you, on the day you eat from it, you will die. Where does Haman come from? He comes from the tree. We have to understand the concept of the tree very briefly, because you all know that, but the concept of Haman and the Malach HaMavis. And we have to understand it in light of another very important so-called personality that is the same as the Malach HaMavis, and that's called the Satan. Okay? Because the Gemara tells us the Satan is the Malach HaMavis. First, it comes to you to entice you, and then when you are seduced by it and you succumb to it, it shows itself to be the Malach HaMavis. Let's talk about this not as angels flying around, some with, pitchforks and all that. We know what the tree represents. We know what the Eitz Hadas represents. We've spoken about it a lot here, okay? We have to speak about it in terms of the bigger picture that we've been trying to build up, and that is looking at the whole construction, the whole philosophical construct of creation, how it's chesed, how the tree of knowledge, subjectivity, free choice is fundamental, how misused it leads to death and destruction, and how that all works together. So let's put a few things together now in a very organized fashion. All kinds of things we've established. Number one, why number one, what is the motive for Hashem to create the world? This is not, this could take hours, but we're going through points here. We say that Hashem created the world out of great chesed. It's all chesed. The name of Hashem for chesed is Kel. And it's also Yud Kei Vav Kei, which means Einod Milvado, no one, the awareness that there's nothing besides Hashem, but the name Kel is the name of chesed. Hashem created the world out of chesed. What's the ultimate chesed? We have another word for that ultimate chesed, the ultimate kindness, the ultimate act of goodness. We call it tzchar, reward. What is reward? So to just to use the words, but this, there are endless books written on this, Sfarim and books. The idea is that of Hashem himself is the essence of all things, Ein Sof, complete, limitless, everything, all what is good, all which is true, all which is existent, all which is eternal, the power of everything, total perfection, goodness, and the source of all of those things in this world. The ultimate good is to have all, to become a part of that, basically, to blend with that, to be, to one's identity be part of, so to speak, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Hashem wanted to bestow, so to speak, himself upon these creatures that he created. So that's called chesed, the ultimate good. In order to do that, what needs to happen? This is Purim, Torah, right? Haster, aster, panai. Hashem must be concealed. Obviously, Hashem's concealment allows us to imagine, to feel, to experience that we are autonomous beings with free choice, and we all feel it. My point of view, my will, what I want to do, Hashem's point of view, his will, what he wants me to do. They're not one and the same, certainly not when we start the process. So that concealment, which we call hester or tzimtzum, allows for an individual to exist that feels independent. Because if HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the creator of all things, of every breath we take and every sight we see and every feeling we have and every thought we think, would be perceived as being the driving engine behind everything we do, then we wouldn't see ourselves as independent and we wouldn't have free choice. So far, so good. Why does Hashem want us to have free choice? So that when we acquire those same qualities that God himself is, such as eternity, truth, goodness, we can acquire the attributes of tov, of good, by doing what Hashem says is tov, of nitzri, of eternal, by attaching ourselves to Hashem in his ways, in our thought, in our speech, in our action. And then as Hashem is eternal, we are eternal. We live on. We can become good by going in the ways that Hashem says is good. We can become emes and conducting ourselves in what Hashem says is emes. We become the very same qualities that Hashem himself is known to us as being. The fact is that we need to acquire them on our own, not to have them given to us as a gift, because if we are like God himself, the most God-like aspect of God is that God is all these things, not because somebody did him a chesed and bestowed it upon him as an act of kindness, because Nebuch, he couldn't do it himself. So the fact that we acquire these things through our own hard work, and as they say today, we own them and they're truly ours and they're never taken away, that makes us like God himself when we begin to blend, to be part of. That's the ultimate tzchar. So far, so good. It sounds like tremendous chesed. Here's the point where the whole thing starts to look more like a evil trap, a malicious trap instead of an act of chesed. What if a person, because of the concealment, and the sense of autonomy, and the sense of independence, and that power of Bechira Chafshis, gets lost in that darkness, in that concealment, and makes that simple mistake that's so easy to make, and thinks, this is all, it's all about me. I am me, I have my interests, I have a right to satisfy them, I want to promote my way of seeing things, I want to take control, I want to be like God, exactly what we just said, eternal, true, controlling, all-powerful, I want to be like God. I want to be instead of God. It's not that I want to acquire God's attributes by being connected to God. That little switch flips and it's I am God and I want to be all those things for myself. The ultimate example of that is Haman. What if that switch goes off like that, like Rav Moshe Shapira calls it a switch katan, then the whole thing isn't chesed anymore. Because what happens to such a person? Yeah, but they not only do they bring evil to the world, what's their end?
Destruction.
nekama and destruction and punishment and kares and every horrible klala. That's not chesed anymore. Hashem creates the concealment. It's so easy to get lost in it. Haman's the example of the furthest reaches of that blindness, of that mistake. He represents all the mistakes, the whole spectrum of mistakes. He's just the epitome of it. He's just the prototype of it, what it looks like in its most vicious, you know, ferocious form. But he represents the whole spectrum. There are little, you know, we switch off in small ways and we switch off in big ways. And then we know that if you switch off at all, there's punishments and there's threats and there's kares and there's gehenim. That's not chesed anymore. That's like a trap. You put us in a world and then you punish us for making the mistake that you allowed us to make by giving us ourselves. So we need a solution to this. We have to understand. And the solution comes in this enigmatic Gemara that the Malach HaMavis revealed to Moshe the Ketores. And it comes to the story of Esther and Mordechai and Haman. The only way to solve this problem, to make it in back, to turn it back into chesed, is to see and what we started talking about last week and understand the concept of nekama. Right? We started introducing this idea. The word nekama in Hodu is sandwiched between two names of Hashem. Kel Nekamos Hashem. Kel is chesed. It represents the chesed that brought this whole world into existence. And Hashem, Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, the name we don't pronounce after the word Nekama, which we normally translate as revenge, represents the awareness of everybody, the total humanity's final awareness of Hashem, that there is nothing but HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It goes by the process of Nekama. The concept of Nekama is what turns what otherwise is a trap back into chesed. Nekama is when the rishus, the mistake that the people make as epitomized in Haman, the evil, the rishus, the darkness, the self and as the center of all things, when that takes on a life of its own and expands and expands and expands and expands to the point where it explodes on itself. That's the inevitability. It always happens. Okay, we might not see it always in our life, but in the story of Purim, we saw it. Every single thing that Haman tried to do, as you know, boomeranged and destroyed him. There are two ways to learn the truth in the world. There's the first way, we've called it Isarusa de Le'ela, when Hashem breaks open the heavens, puts on a show, great miracles, prophecy, awe and shock, Moshe bringing the Torah on Har Sinai. And that's one way to inform the people of the truth. However, that way, as you know, doesn't work. And it really doesn't transform people because it's information and enlightenment that comes at the people from the outside. It overwhelms them, they see it, but it doesn't come from inside. It's not their personal experience. They're learning the truth by being taught the truth from an outside force. Okay? There's another way to learn the truth, not by being taught the truth, but by process of elimination, which every single other, substitute for the truth, everything else that claims to be the truth, that looks like the truth, that looks like it has the capacity to undermine, vanquish, defeat Hashem's truth. And the more it looks like it's just about to defeat God and His will and everything He set up in this world, right? When that explodes and defeats itself, one time, two times, after a few times, by process of elimination, it becomes clear, Ein od milvado. There's nothing but Hashem's will, and nothing will undermine it. So that rishus itself, by its own destruction, becomes a greater form of Giloy Shechina than God Himself teaching us what's right and wrong. A greater form of learning the truth, of enlightenment. Because there's a different experience when it's taught to you, the Torah of Moshe, which came with a certain mountain over their heads, right? We're told that Hashem held the mountain over their heads. That means to tell us that Hashem overwhelm them with the revelation that paralyzed them. And they stopped in their tracks and they said, Nasa v'nishma. Right? That's one way. But more powerful than that, because that way isn't pleasurable. That's really the way of fear of Hashem. But the pleasurable way to learn that same lesson is by seeing evil destroy itself. That's a whole different experience. There's something entirely satisfying. And we don't have to do a thing. Esther did nothing. Mordechai did nothing. Everything Hashem Haman did, he did to himself. It all worked out beautifully. That's a great pleasure, a great joy in seeing that. In fact, here we go to a very interesting description of the sequence of events of Purim. It says the following. It says here, and also Gemara, that talks about all of these things, a lot of these things we've been mentioning, that by the original acceptance of the Torah, the Jewish people, as you know, they had there's an element of coercion. By Purim, we know, Kimu v'kiblu, it says in the Megillah, Perek 9, Pasuk 27, Kimu v'kiblu, they confirmed and they accepted, meaning they confirmed what they had already accepted, they re-accepted the Torah, and the time of Purim. So Rashi says, this was the sequence of events, commenting on the Gemara. The Gemara says the sequence, but Rashi tells us what it means. First they fasted and they prayed. Then Hashem did the great miracle of bringing Haman's bad back upon himself, right? His bad intentions back upon himself. Then, out of great love for the miracle, they re-accepted the Torah that they had originally accepted out of fear in the time of Moshe. Me'avas hanes, love of the miracle that was done to them. Now, normally we don't love the miracle, we love the outcome of the miracle. What is love? The outcome is they were saved. They should have loved the fact that they were not annihilated by what? The miracle itself, he's saying. There's a tremendous pleasure and love that begins to grow when we see this type of a miracle, the rishus destroying itself, and it brings us to want to accept the Torah because everything falls into place. It all works out. All the pieces of the puzzle work out perfectly together. And in the end, what's right is right, and what's wrong is wrong, and that's the way it must be, and therefore that's the way it is. And there's nothing to do about it. All the rishus is turned into good. It's the nahapochu. Haman becomes the one, the Malach HaMavis, who gives birth, so to speak, promotes Esther and Mordechai. He gives us the Ketores. And we haven't spoken about the Ketores yet. We're talking about Malach HaMavis. We're talking about the idea that that we said that the world is chesed. We said that there's a problem with this formula when you get to the rishus, to a wicked person, to a person who makes a mistake, to anyone who sins, and then is threatened with a punishment. It all falls apart. You add the concept of this nekama, which doesn't mean you get to rip your enemy to shreds because you're angry at him. It means that the evil implodes upon itself. That makes everything work. That puts the order back into everything. That makes everything an extension of the chesed, because what happens is nobody, not even the Russia, the perpetrator, gets lost. The perpetrator promotes what they're trying to destroy. The perpetrator, against their will, becomes the greatest spokesperson for the truth they're trying to destroy. So they're even saved. No one's ever lost. That's the chesed. Now, the example of this is Korach. He himself, so to speak, is screaming out what he was trying to destroy. Moshe emes v'torasso emes. Moshe's true and his Torah is true. Now, this is the concept of the Malach HaMavis. The Malach HaMavis, let's take it down, is the switch. The Satan. The Satan is the force in us to be independent. That which gives us Bechira Chavshis, which gives us an opportunity to overcome the desire to see ourselves as a center of all things, that's called the Satan. It's not meant to win the battle. It's meant to present the challenge so we choose to see the world correctly, not in a self-serving way. That's called the Satan. It lives in us. We make the correct choice. Then we become a vehicle for Hashem's, you know, presence here in this world. We make the wrong choice. That Satan becomes the Malach HaMavis, and it will destroy us. But when it destroys us, and it will destroy us, when we do the wrong thing, it eats us up inside. It leads to self-loathing. It leads to being disheartened. It leads to yeesh, giving up on oneself. It leads to a person becoming bitter and becoming cynical, saying, you know, people are people and nobody can really salvage themselves. Nobody can really elevate themselves. We all succumb to our base instincts. You know, why be so? Why, what do you expect? You know, who's, and you become embittered. and a person becomes hopeless. It's the Malach HaMavis. Freud talks about it. The death wish in a person, it leads to inertia, it leads to depression, it leads to suicide, it leads to misery, it leads to anger, it leads to all the negative emotions that destroy us. So the Satan, when we get fooled by it and start perceiving things as, you know, incorrectly, as revolving around ourselves, it becomes a Malach HaMavis. But don't worry. The Malach HaMavis gives birth to the Ketores. The Malach HaMavis gives us the Ketores. The Malach HaMavis, by its destruction and the misery a person feels by making all those wrong choices, that itself is the process of elimination where you come to know what's right. It becomes for us the process of elimination. Now, here's the thing. Haman didn't know that Moshe was born in Adar and let his birth come and atone for his death. Who brought Moshe back to life? What does it mean that Moshe died? What does it mean he was reborn? The Kabbalah HaTorah of Moshe, the one on Har Sinai, the one out of an element of fear, the one that came from the outside, it died. Its force withered away. They sinned. The temple was destroyed. They were taken to exile. Obviously, what Moshe had initiated withered away. It died out. But through the Purim story, and Haman's intentions, and the nekama, which is a chesed of God, the revenge as we just described it, which is a chesed, where this worst person becomes the greatest advocate for the truth through themselves, against their will, but that's their tikkun, right? That brought the Jews back to life, and they re-accepted the Torah, this time with love and joy. So Moshe was reborn. Who gave birth to Moshe? Haman did. Haman brought Moshe back to life. So it says he knew he died in Adar, but he didn't know he was born. He didn't know he was giving birth to Moshe in Adar. He was re-bringing Moshe and Moshe's giving of the Torah back to life on a whole new level, a level where the Jewish people learned the truth by process of elimination through themselves. And they loved that experience because it's the most pleasurable experience in the world to have that happen. And to be able to watch it happen when after it's all done. So it's Haman who gives birth to Moshe. In fact, what Moshe says in astonishing words here, he said, I wouldn't say it unless he said it, but he says it. He says, yet since he reached the peak of evil, talking about Haman, he himself became Moshe Rabbeinu. Through him the Torah was given to Israel. He was the one who brought about the completion of Torah acceptance. This indeed is the goal of creation, to reach a point that evil itself will declare its own falseness and reveal where the truth exists. So now he says, let his birth come and atone for his death. Doesn't that make sense? The rebirth of Kimu v'Kiblu, they reaccepted the Torah with great love on Purim, atones for the death of Moshe, which is that we let Moshe's Torah die, so to speak, that we loosened our grip on it. That we, you know, we weren't so connected, we weren't so committed to it anymore. We need an atonement for that, right? And that's what led to the Chorban, the destruction. That's what led to the Golos they were in. You need an atonement. So the rebirth of Moshe is an atonement for the death of Moshe. And of course, after Esther, Daryavesh, who's either her biological child or her ideological child, let the Jewish people go back to Eretz Yisrael and rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. Now, we've spoken about the idea that Haman's the expression of the eights in its fullest form, of that switch. We've spoken about how until you get to that concept of nekama, evil revealing the truth, the world there's something missing in the chesed formula. This completes the chesed formula. Nobody is lost. As we said, Haman is the ultimate furthest extension of rishus, but it's all the little degrees in between. Nobody's ever lost. And that's where Avraham Kaplan says that when a person starts experiencing their Gehenna, which is this, where their mistakes in the light of reality come back to cause them so much pain and suffering of how they could have been so wrong, and the death embedded in the darkness of the mistake becomes their source of life. He says that they welcome with great love the process of the tikkun, of the cleansing, that the Gehenim process, the cleansing process, is doing for them. It's making them and their mistakes we don't want to go this way, obviously, into a source of knowledge of truth. It's turning their darkest moments into light moments for them. And and that's really at the core of what we mean when we say resurrection of the dead, Tchiyas HaMeisim. It means that every time a person lives in a moment that is dead, that is darkness, that is about themselves, that moment doesn't exist for them. And it's a moment of non-existence. It's a worthless, wasted moment. We accumulate, unfortunately, a lot of these moments. They're dead, so that only the moments in where we are connected to life, to Hashem, through the mitzvahs, to eternity, live. What about all those years, all those huge patches of time that are dead? Tchiyas HaMeisim means that HaKadosh Baruch Hu can retrieve those dead moments, those Malach HaMavis moments, and turn them into living moments by the process of their own pain causing us the suffering, causing us the regret and the humiliation, and teaching us the truth. Anytime a person has an opportunity to make a mistake and then suffer the negative consequences from it and learn the lesson from it, it's something to be incredibly grateful for. Either way, a person is used by HaKadosh Baruch Hu as a vehicle. And what we have to do now is we have to now talk about the ketores, that's the sweet smell that comes to life because of the Malach HaMavis. Let's say a person experiences that. What happens beyond that is they exist in a state where they're compared to really ketores, to the smell. Now, what is that? This has very otherworldly ramifications. First of all, smell is the only sense not involved in the Eitz Hadas. In other words, she saw the fruit, she ate it, whoever, you know who she is. It's us, it's that ego that switches to me, right? She says, I can't touch it, but she touches it, right? All the senses are involved, except she hears the snake, except smell. Smell remains pure and untainted, and when all of the effects of death, the Malach HaMavis, of the switch, of the Satan, are finally eliminated, they've been cleansed. What's left is the sweet smell, and that alone. Interestingly enough, it's the sense of smell that lets us distinguish between what is alive and fresh. And there's no sweeter experience than that, to smell something fresh, a flower, a baby. And our nose, smell is what helps us instantly recognize when something is dead and decaying. It's the smell. It senses what's dead and what's alive. And there's no confusion in the sense of smell. Either it's foul, it's an odor, or it's pleasant. It's a pleasant aroma. Reach nichoach, a pleasant aroma. That's what it's called in the Torah. Hashem says the Klal Yisrael, when they do the service in the temple, they present. It creates a pleasant aroma for God. It's alive, what means we're alive, we're connected. When we finally rid ourselves of the force in us, the Satan, which becomes the Malach HaMavis, which teaches us a lesson and becomes our tikkun, and the falsity that reveals the truth, when that finally plays itself out, what's left? What's left after Haman played his whole game? Esther and Mordechai. That was left. The ketores, the smell. That's what's left. The smell of life. The smell that instantly knows what's alive and what's dead. And this is otherworldly in another sense, because, and this is a beautiful piece, it's such a beautiful book, one of my favorites also, The Long Shorter Way by Rav Adin Steinsaltz. It's essays on the Tanya. Really nice. So in one chapter here, the chapter on the animal soul, this is a big term by
is that by the Tanya?
It's by Rav Adin Steinsaltz, but it's essays that he wrote on the Tanya. So chapter 9, he writes about the difference between, and it's really the difference between the process and the destination. He writes about the difference between what he calls love or pleasures of desire and pleasures of delight. A pleasure of desire, which is all part of our process here, and it's the other kelim in the Beis HaMikdash, the Shulchan and the menorah that we spoke about, and the outside mizbeach where they offered the animals. Love of desire is what we experience here. Something's missing, and we need to satisfy it, and we feel gratification when we satisfy it, right? So I love a certain type of food. I love a person. I feel lost and alone without them. I love knowledge. I can't survive without it. But the problem with love of desire is that without it, there's a terrible void. It's intertangled. It's entangled with pain, with a certain tragic truth that you really can't have entirely what you love. You can't utterly satisfy the longing. You can't inhale and consume the person that you love and become that they're part of you. You can't have all the knowledge you're seeking, and you can't have all the peace that you're seeking. The love of desire is by its nature a painful experience, a process of feeling a void, and it's very healthy, and it's what drives us to achieve the right things. But that's of this world. Now, that type would be a love of eating something, you know, fulfilling a hunger, the satisfaction of eating, or having something physically. Plato actually talks about pure and impure pleasures. He talks about impure pleasures as pleasures that always come with that tragic yearning, that emptiness. Here, he says it here beautifully. He doesn't call it pure and impure. He calls it, as we said, desire and delight. He says, this love, which is like a fire, is a desire for that which is lacking. And like a flame, the more it feeds the desire, the more intense it becomes. It also grows with deprivation, becoming a passion that is nourished on thoughts of the object of its desire. For this reason, it remains forever in the domain of longing, of yearning for fulfillment. Essentially, it is a love of the self. It is ultimately for one's own satisfaction, because you need these things to live. There's another kind of love, but he says it's otherworldly bliss, where it's not about me missing something because I'm by nature lacking. It's when the love is love of something for its own sake and not for myself at all. Not to feed a longing, but for the thing itself. For example, the difference between eating, the pleasure of eating, which you need it because you're hungry, and the pleasure of smelling a rose, smelling something. Smell, ketores, the Eitz Hadas, it was not affected by smell. Smelling something delightful, that's called the pleasure of delight. It's not feeding a longing. It's just a pleasure for the pleasure itself is a pleasure. The rose has a smell, and the smell is beautiful, and you're enjoying it, and that's what it is. And this is the nature, this is what ketores is telling us. This is Yom Kippur, the highest point, the day when we're all pure, where we're like malachim. There's a type of pleasure that the ultimate pleasure, the ultimate schar, it's that comes after evil imploding and becoming a witness for truth. It becomes after kimu v'kibluk, re-accepting the Torah out of that great love and pleasure and joy. Then it becomes an attachment to Torah that totally supersedes the way we attach to it here, because Purim is a glimpse at the nature of life in the end of days. Purim, the Gemara tells us, is a glimpse of Achris Hayamim. It's the end of days. It's the end of the whole story. That's what Purim is about. Purim is put there right before we start this 2,500-year period of Jewish history leading up to the final goal of the days of Mashiach. Purim is put there to give us a glimpse of what that's like. And that's why it's all about the ketores. It's an experience of loving something that's perfect for itself. It's an experience where there's no pain involved. There's no emptiness involved. There's no loss involved. It's something we don't have here. We could barely relate to it. The only way we relate to it is smelling. And that's why we smell a Motzei Shabbos. We've come off of Shabbos. There's something pleasurable about just being in Shabbos. You go back into the work week. You need food, clothing, and shelter, all the pursuits that are forbidden to be involved in on Shabbos. Shabbos, you're freed from all that. It's just the Shabbos. And that relates to the sense of smell. And he says here, when the self ceases to be the most important things in the world, when the self ceases to be the most important thing in the world, and one's yearnings and desires no longer torment the soul, it becomes possible to love the object of our adoration for its own sake. And he talks about this is the love of delight, and he says there's a radiance in this feeling, never diminished, not affected by any type of distance or parting. He says that this is the derech to get there. However, he says one unbelievable, profound thought. he says that to develop this type of love, okay, and this is why there's a kimuv, a kiblu, of Purim after Moshe's. Why Moshe's had to, so to speak, lead to the love of the Torah that came with Purim. He says the following. I'll read it to you in his own words. This is real genius. He says, what's supposed to happen, this is the nature of life, right? The burning and flame-like, desiring love of God is supposed to consume the separate self of the lover and make it less of an obstacle to union, right? It's supposed to be that this huge desire to have meaning, to be connected to Hashem, should overwhelm the person, and the ani, you know, kind of like melts into HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The ani, as we spoke about it, becomes part of the anochi, anochi Hashem Lekecha, but it's not set up like that so easily, as we all know. But it so happens, and only too often, passion feeds the ego. The self grows stronger and is made more capable of desires of all kinds. So great passion, which is supposed to overwhelm a person and bring them to love Hashem for Hashem's sake, is passion. And passion goes like this with the ego. It makes the person feel themselves and their yearnings and their desires. And it brings all kinds of other egotistical desires to the forefront. So he says, what has to happen? So prevalent is this obstinacy of the self that the sages have claimed that the only safe way to this type of delight, love of delight, pure love, is through the fear of God. Is through fear. Is through the fear of God. That's why Moshe, Kabbalah Satorah, the mountain over their heads, must precede Purim. It means accepting the Torah. He says earlier, which is also so true, he says that serving Hashem out of fear, in other words, not fear of punishment so much, but recognition of Hashem's power and control and instructions to us and having a healthy acknowledgement of what's right and wrong and complying. In other words, a fear of what this Torah says. This is wrong, this is right, this you can't do. Fear
is a punishment threatening.
It's a certain element of threat, but it's a healthy threat. For example, the fear of walking over the edge of the Empire State Building. That fear comes from knowledge. When the knowledge is clear, then you have a certain, you know, healthy, you know, fear of doing the wrong thing.
I heard it described as reverence.
That's true. Yeah, that's, do we... You can call it that. When you stand at the end of the Empire State Building and you're about to take a step, you have reverence for gravity, yeah. You also have a certain healthy fear. Whatever, fine. You could call it that. But the way to love has got to go by virtue first through the element of a certain distance, of a certain healthy respect and knowledge of what is and what isn't, or reverence, that keeps a person from allowing the passion to be close to Hashem, to give birth to ignite all the other passions that take them away from Hashem. That's why it has to go in this derech. And in the end, it comes to the experience of the sweet smell, the delight of loving something for its own beauty, and not because it's somehow satisfying something I'm missing. So this Purim is very, very, it's considered like Yom HaKippurim, just the opposite side of the coin of the holiest day of the year. It's a very auspicious day. And we are Zohar, and this day Moshe will be reborn in all of us. Okay, everybody, have a wonderful week. Tanya has to make an announcement.
I have a short-